Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we have a very, very timely and interesting, a sort of wide-ranging topic to talk about, and this is when divorce, infidelity, harassment, and the workplace mix, issues that folks should look out for. And to talk about this wide-ranging number of issues, we've got two Joseph Greenwald & Lake lawyers. And the first is Erica Jacobson-White. Erica represents survivors of employment discrimination, sexual abuse, civil rights, and personal injury throughout Maryland, the District of Columbia, and the state of California. Her career-long commitment to representing real people facing tough challenges in their lives has resulted in significant results for her clients at trial, mediation, and arbitration, recovering millions of dollars for her clients over the course of her career. We also have Lindsay Parvis, a family law attorney and principal at Joseph Greenwald & Lake. Lindsay's practice focuses on advocating for parents, spouses, and children in family legal disputes such as child custody and divorce. Welcome to both of you. Thanks so much for the two of you joining us today.
Thanks for having us here.
Well, let's jump right in, folks, and there's no order here, so feel free to interrupt and go back and forth. This is an interesting area that I know a lot of people have read about and would probably like to know more about. So let's start with from the top down, right? And what if in a situation where someone works with their spouse or their romantic partner or their spouse or their partner is their boss, and they're going through a breakup? What kind of things do you see? What kind of things should you look out for?
Well, from the family law perspective, you want to look for things like income reduction by either spouse, because this could have an impact on alimony if they are married. And when I talk about spouses, I'm also referring to romantic partners. It can also have an impact on child support. So some of the things that come to mind would be, is there a voluntary reduction in the income? And does this raise the potential for voluntary impoverishment? And what voluntary impoverishment means is when a court finds that a parent has deliberately become unemployed or underemployed and reduced their income in order to avoid paying child support or potentially alimony. And one of the complicating factors when you have spouses or romantic partners who work together, what happens if one terminates the employment of the other? And how that might come into play with voluntary impoverishment. I have a couple other thoughts on the family law issues, but Erica, what about the employment issues?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting the point that you bring up of if the spouse is, for example, in a supervisory position and terminates the other spouse from employment, certainly that could dovetail into issues of discrimination or harassment or retaliation in the workplace. It's unlawful to harass someone or discriminate against someone because of their sex or gender under federal law, and there's additional protections under some state laws as well. So certainly if a spouse terminates their spouse as a result of a divorce, it could relate to some form of discrimination if it's based on the person's gender or based on the person's withholding of sex from them, for example. That could relate to retaliation for sexual harassment or some kind of quid pro quo harassment where the harassment is bargain for exchange. In other words, if you're not having sex with me, you can't work here anymore. That's illegal. So certainly there are some protections for spouses in that situation.
So Lindsay, just to sort of follow up with what Erica just said, it sounds like there's two areas where you need to, general areas where you from a family law side are looking out for. One is where you have the angry partner, right, who's looking to get rid of, terminate, cut the income of the other. And the other, I suppose, is where you've got the partner who also may be angry, but is looking to, in a deceitful way, try to find a way to minimize his or her financial exposure going forward.
That's right. And some of the ways that we see these conflicts unfold can be in mismanagement of the business while a family business, while the family is undergoing a breakup. And that can sometimes lead to having a parallel business litigation. What I mean by that is you have your family law case, but you can also have a separate case that's going on involving the business. And for example, receivership, having someone else come in to manage the business so that the spouse's or romantic partner's conflict isn't actually causing the business to fail. And then you have some issues around, in the marital context, the spouse is getting rid of business assets. And this can tie into issues of what the value of the business is as a marital asset, and then trying to recapture the value of assets that have been gotten rid of, and have they been dissipated or wasted, which are some of the legal terms around that. And then, of course, you have some practical issues around the potential with if employment were to terminate, that could lead to termination of benefits like health insurance for the spouse or the employee. And at least right now under Maryland law, there's not a clear path to reinstating that. In any event, just some of the complications that can arise in these situations.
Erica, let me ask you. So someone comes to you in a circumstance as Lindsay has described. My partner, my spouse has basically done whatever needs to be done. So I'm getting, you know, cut loose, getting terminated from my position. What do you look for? How do you handle that type of investigation, A? And B, are there circumstances where you team up or work with the person's family lawyer on the domestic relations side?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. There are situations where it can be helpful to at least make contact with, for example, a victim of domestic violence with their family lawyer to understand what's going on in the family law case. If there is a situation where an employee, for example, has been terminated and it's resultant from harassment or some kind of infidelity or something like that, and there might be a path to recovery from an employment discrimination context or retaliation context, the damages in that context, one of the categories of damages you can recover is for your emotional distress. But obviously, a victim of domestic violence, their emotional distress can be complicated by a lot of factors. So it can be really helpful in those scenarios to be in touch with the victim's attorney who's representing them in the domestic violence case or in the custody case or something like that. I've certainly seen situations where I've represented victims of harassment and the employer has then gone after their family law records and used them in depositions. So it can absolutely impact an employment discrimination case, and it can be helpful to be in touch.
And so the target of that type of investigation is not just the spouse or significant other, right? It's the person, the entity that they both were working for, I suppose.
Correct. So there are a variety of scenarios where the employer can be held liable for an employee who's engaging in harassment in the workplace. There are only limited situations where the employee themselves, under certain state laws like California or in DC, you can be held individually liable for harassment. But otherwise, it's the employer who's liable for harassment. So actually, one of the things that can happen and one of the places that these issues intersect is if the employer is being held liable for harassment, let's say of a supervisory level employee, let's say the employer does the right thing and they find that that supervisory employee has engaged in harassment or retaliation by terminating their spouse. In that situation, the harassing spousal employee actually could end up losing their job as well. And so that could play out also in the family law context because they could be terminated by the employer for their conduct.
Let's slide over to the whole texting, sexting thing that we read so much about. And in fact, was in the news to some degree this week with that political consultant John Weaver and the Lincoln Project and all that stuff. But you hear about this all the time. You hear about it in politics. You hear about it in government. You hear about it in the public and private sector. But I do want to focus on, you know, the relationship piece, right? So you've got one spouse who finds sects or texts from his or her spouse, significant other, to a coworker? What happens? What do you look for? What are the concerns?
Erica, why don't you start with the employment side?
Okay. So there's a number of concerns that could arise in that context. Certainly one issue is your spouse the supervisor in that situation, or are they a coworker? That issue goes more to whether or not the employer would be held liable for that kind of conduct. So harassment has to be unwanted, first of all. And then there's two different main types of harassment. One is hostile work environment, which a lot of people have heard about. This is when the conduct is severe or pervasive enough to alter the terms and conditions of employment. There's also quid pro quo, which I mentioned earlier, which is this bargain for exchange idea of harassment. So when you're seeing these sexting or text messages, you know, one of the issues is, are these messages unwanted? and is your spouse engaging in sexual harassment, which could expose them to individual liability and expose their employer to liability? So I think that would be the first question I would ask. And then that kind of dovetails into some of the issues that could arise. Like if they are engaging in harassment, well, they could face termination for that. So that could certainly impact the divorce proceedings.
What about the potential liability that could trail? Let's say that the person who's the target of this harassment, be it sexting or texting, files suit, you know, has you represent them, brings an action, whatever it looks like, against the perpetrator and against the employer. What if any risks, you know, bleed down to the spouse and to the rest of the family of the person who's been doing this kind of thing?
Well, because of the spousal privilege, marital communications are protected from discovery because they're considered confidential. So the marital communications themselves are not going to come into play in the employment discrimination context for the most part. But that doesn't mean that it won't impact the spouse, because if the harassing spouse gets terminated, like I said, it could obviously impact marital assets in a major way.
And income, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Lindsay, let's toggle over to the family law side.
Sure thing. So when it comes to texting and sexting in the divorce context, it has a role in potentially the grounds for divorce, which means what is the legal basis for the court to grant this couple a divorce. And one of the grounds for divorce in Maryland is adultery. Now, texting, romantic texting and sexting is not alone considered adultery. In order to prove adultery in Maryland under current law, it's usually proven through circumstantial evidence. Is there opportunity and disposition? So did this couple have the opportunity to be together and be physically intimate and observed to have had that opportunity? And then have there been interactions between this adulterous couple to show that there's a romantic relationship and therefore likely that in having this opportunity that they were intimate? So the texting, sexting could be a part of circumstantial evidence of adultery, but it doesn't automatically prove adultery in a divorce case. And what the texting, sexting example sort of brings to mind are larger issues of whether or not this is in fact a romantic relationship, and is there marital money being spent on the paramour and therefore not available to be divided in the divorce? There is the potential that if the paramour is engaged in some extremely detrimental behavior that would be harmful to the children, whether or not that paramour should have contact with the minor children, that's a pretty big mountain to climb, but something just to have an eye on because it can creep up sometimes. And then the reason for the breakup of a marriage is also a relevant consideration in how property is divided in a divorce, and also alimony. And as Erica mentioned, you can have some interplay, which could be a whole other podcast, around spousal communications and spousal privilege, and when these sorts of communications can and cannot be used.
Let me ask you a quick question to briefly interrupt you, and that has to do with the sexting and texting and how you use it as a family lawyer. So what I'm hearing you say is that while it may not be sufficient to get you that adultery claim to get you from being married to being divorced, it can certainly play a part or maybe a smoking gun of sorts in terms of you as the lawyer for that client using those communications to try to prove, I guess, to some degree, why the marriage broke up and then therefore move that to recovering or moving some money to your client's side of the ledger. Does that sound right?
Oh, that is right. And around this issue, timing is everything. So when to disclose those communications can play a big part in how much of a benefit can be accomplished by using them. And it also depends entirely upon one's own client and what one's own client is trying to accomplish. And there's not a one-size-fits-all approach for how to use this, but it's definitely a conversation to be had, to be explored with a client about how and when to raise this and to what extent.
So there is one issue that just sort of popped into my mind that I think is worth noting, which is that I think there are situations maybe when a spouse may want to try to record their spouse to sort of catch them in the act. And this isn't something that I've discussed with Lindsay before, but I don't know if that comes up in your practice. Certainly it comes up in mine in a variety of contexts. And I just want to note that the laws vary a lot state to state as to whether you can record phone calls or whether it's illegal to do so without two-party consent or all-party consent. For example, in DC, you just need the consent of one party, but in Maryland, it's all parties need to consent. So I think it's just worth noting that you should not record conversations unless you talk to a lawyer to find out if doing so would be legal, because it can be illegal, it can be a crime. And so even though you may want to try to, you know, catch a harasser, for example, in the act of sexually harassing you, you really want to check with a lawyer before you engage in some conduct like that.
Yeah, just a quick story to follow up on that. Many years ago, I tried a case where a divorce case where the husband was pro se. In other words, he didn't have a lawyer. And during the course of the trial, he brought a tape recorder in, and my client was on the stand. He was going to cross-examine his soon-to-be former spouse, and he went to push the button on the tape recorder. The judge looked at him and said, "Are you sure you want to play that?" He said, "Absolutely." And she asked him a second time. He said, "Absolutely." Asked him a third time. He said, "Absolutely." Hit the button, and then she had the sheriff come up and escort him out. And she took a break. So that's an important issue for any folks who are in a family law environment. What can be done? What can't be done? I'm glad you brought that up. In terms of, let's talk about stalking and harassment, and we see that in the employment scenario. We see that between co-employees, between supervisors and so forth. Can we talk a little bit, Erica, in terms of what you look for from the employment perspective?
Yeah. So being stalked by or a victim of domestic violence and how that interacts in the workplace is a really delicate situation. And the laws do vary a lot in terms of the level of protection that employees have from state to state. So, for example, Maryland really doesn't have any specific protections enumerated for victims of domestic violence or stalking. You absolutely can still get a protective order and share it with your employer and have them enforce it. There are certain situations where, for example, if you're forced out of the workplace where you could qualify for unemployment, even though you're a victim, because you're a victim of domestic violence or stalking, there's certain levels of proof that you have to go through to get the unemployment insurance in that scenario. But you can also have protections, for example, in Maryland or in any state that doesn't have specific protections enumerated. There are still ways that you can get protection. For example, if you're suffering from injuries, whether they be physical or emotional injuries, as a result of the domestic violence. You could be entitled, depending on how large your employer is, you could be entitled to up to 12 weeks of job protected leave. You could also be entitled to certain reasonable accommodations in the workplace for your short or long-term disabilities resultant from that domestic violence. And also, there are certain situations where if your employer is treating victims of domestic violence differently, for example, or giving different privileges to men and women based on gender, you could have protections under Title VII. So, for example, I can think of a scenario where, for example, a woman is not allowed to leave the workplace to get a protective order, but men are allowed to leave to attend custody proceedings. In that situation, you might be able to demonstrate that there's gender-based rules being made that are being unequally applied in the workplace. There are, in certain states, though, quite robust protections. It's more rare. DC has recently amended the DC Human Rights Act. And in October 2019, it went into effect that victims of domestic violence or stalking are now protected, or sexual offenses. They're now protected. It's considered a protected class. So you can get additional protections that way if you're in DC. California also has similar laws as well.
And so, Lindsay, now let's go back to the family law side. What kind of things can you do for that person who's being harassed or being stalked by an ex at the workplace?
So the first kind of point to look at is what is the nature of the romantic relationship and what are the ex's behaviors? The reason I say that is because there are two types of protective orders in Maryland. There's a peace order, which can be available to folks who have been in a romantic relationship, but not a physically intimate one, depending upon the circumstances. And then there's a protective order. And with the peace order, one can get protection both for stalking and harassment. But in a protective order, you can get protection for stalking, but not the harassment, at least not so far under current law. And with these, the type of relationship between the couple is what is going to then determine which order's available. And it's also worth noting that the types of protections that are available with each order can look different. Peace orders tend to be in the nature of no contact and stay away from certain locations and do not abuse or threaten to abuse, with some additional protections. But protective orders can be much more encompassing. That can include the stalker harasser, if a romantic partner in living together, to be required to leave the home. It can include custody of children and emergency family maintenance, so financial support for a period of time. And then there are also some distinctions between the two, which can come into play in stalking and harassing situations. Things like revenge porn and criminal visual surveillance and criminal misuse of telephone and electronic devices. So you may be able to get an order for some of those if you have the quote unquote right type of qualifying relationship, but not for some of those other acts if you don't. And then something to explore in the family context, generally speaking, about domestic violence protective orders and intimate partner violence orders, is whether or not the protective order is practical or will have far-reaching, more detrimental consequences for the family vis-a-vis employment. So in those situations, something that can be considered is whether or not to have a no-contact agreement that is not a formal protective order. And that no-contact agreement could be part of a consent order in a family law divorce case, for example, or a family law custody case if folks are unmarried or not pursuing divorce, so that it is a court order. It just tends to have a different weight from a domestic violence protective order or a peace order. That said, sometimes you have to look at the bigger context of the family and if protecting the employment and therefore the income stream is more important to the safety of the family in order to provide financial resources versus the potential termination of employment and having what might be a more robust court order. And that's something that's best explored with an attorney before deciding which path to pursue.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. To the average bear, it sounds confusing, right? Is it a peace order? Is it a protective order? What risks do I have? I still need him or her to be earning and so forth. That's a lot to wrangle through if you don't spend your life in the law books, I guess.
It is. And the peace and protective orders have been evolving over time. And by and large, for example, each legislative session, you usually see a lot of changes to the peace and protective orders, recognizing that over time, there's been overlap. There's been confusion. There's been difficulty in understanding when you have a romantic relationship, but it's not a marriage, or maybe it hasn't yet been an intimate relationship, kind of which orders can apply. So that's been confusing. And then also, unfortunately, there is confusion over trying to weigh what is going to provide necessary protections without cutting off the income stream. And these are tough decisions for clients to make. Hopefully, they'll be able to do that in consultation with a lawyer. And while I certainly represent and welcome representing people in these situations, for those who truly do not qualify, there are lots of service providers for folks who are survivors of intimate partner and domestic violence to be able to get free legal representation if they truly cannot afford an attorney to get that advice.
Erica, let me pivot a little bit and let's talk about where two co-employees are having a relationship, having an affair, whatever you want to call it. Are there any concerns that you look that you see there? Any issues that arise in those types of circumstances? I guess, and this goes for people who I suppose are co-employees and then others who are co-employees, but also in a supervisory capacity.
Yeah. So, if it's a consensual relationship that's happening, it could still be in violation of an employer policy and could result in one of the parties being terminated or both parties being terminated. So that's always a concern. There's often no fraternization policies that employers have. So even consensual fraternization can be grounds for termination, even if it's not illegal termination. So that's one thing to consider. One of the things that I was thinking about while Lindsay was talking was that, in situations where the parties work together and you're trying to get the employer to enforce a peace or protective order, can get quite complicated in the workplace. And that is certainly one of the times where having both an employment lawyer and a family lawyer talking to each other can be really, really helpful. It would vary a lot state to state about what the employer obligations are with respect to providing those accommodations to enforce the peace or protective orders. And it would also vary a lot in terms of what protections the employee who's the victim of the domestic violence that's seeking the protective order would have if the employer then takes retaliatory actions against them. So, for example, under DC's amendments, taking steps to protect the safety of a victim of domestic violence is now considered a reasonable accommodation unless it imposes an undue hardship on the employer. So figuring out what would impose an undue hardship is a nuanced legal analysis. And so it would be really helpful to talk to a lawyer in such a situation. So you might have a peace or protective order, and you may know that you can go to your employer and ask them to try to enforce it, for example, to get you schedule changes so you're not on the same shift as your abuser. But there may be scenarios where your employer can get off the hook for enforcing those accommodations because they can articulate that it's an undue hardship for the business and then you could end up without a job. And certainly, as Lindsay was saying, that could be really devastating to a victim of domestic violence, especially if they're trying to get out from underneath their abuser and maybe protect the children and they need an income source. So really important time to talk to a lawyer.
Very, very interesting. I want to thank both of you for joining us today. We could probably go on for another 2 or 3 hours, but everyone's got some work to do, I think. So before we sign off, Erica, if folks want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to reach you?
Right now, you can call us directly at Joseph Greenwald and Lake. You can also reach me on my mobile phone, 510-496-1409. One of the things that I have to say is great about, since I teamed up with JGL, is that I have resources like you and Lindsay. So when I do talk to employees who are facing some of these issues, I've got a whole family law division that I can call up and ask these questions to. So I'd encourage, any employees facing these issues to reach out.
Excellent. And Lindsay, how would folks get hold of you?
The best way to reach me is through my office number, 240-399-7900.
All right. Everyone, thank you so much for listening in today. We look forward to our next episode. Please join us when we're back on. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.